All right, so this is video number 5, attempt 3. Hopefully Windows will not attack me anymore. So, quick recap. Andrew, Cox, J.J. Boyd, Justin Wilson. It's the full team. So this is the part where we take our rings and we combine them. Like that. And then
Captain Router?
Captain Router. I think you're the closest one to having a green mullet, Andrew, so you get to be Captain Router once everything combines. All I know is I don't want to be the guy with heart. He was like the lamest. He couldn't do anything cool.
You get a pet monkey.
Yeah. And that, unless you're going to like teach him to steal stuff, he's pretty useless. I think that. Although he might be good at picking up women. I don't know. How enticing is a monkey to a woman? They love cute furry things, right? It totally work. So, I'm switching gears. Perhaps where I was trying to start before was the wrong thing. Maybe that's fate's way of telling me that I was doing it wrong, or Microsoft's way of telling me I was doing it wrong. You know, whatever. Bow to my Microsoft overlords. So, somebody had a question which I think was a really good question, and it was basically surrounding. It would be great if you could talk about how to future-proof your networks, or maybe even how you try to upgrade. I'm guessing he's talking about how you upgrade now to kind of solve tomorrow's problems, or what's the best way to kind of plan for the future, I think. And I think that word right there, plan, is probably the very best thing to start with. You need a good game plan. Most people's wireless networks, it seem like, they decide, hey, you know, I just need some connectivity from here to there. How do I do it? I'll do a shot off this grain elevator or something similar to that, off the silo, and then I'll get to my network. And from there, somebody else needs a little bit of connectivity, so they start from there. And then things just seem to kind of grow organically, you know, from one place to the next. And they don't really have a game plan to start with, and I think that's going to be about the time, once they start getting loops and stuff like that, that they end up calling people like us here. So I think step number one is have a plan. Come up with a good, solid network design and something that's repeatable, you know, and move forward. And when I say repeatable, the thing that usually pops into mind is cookie cutter. And I know Justin has been building up material for the MUM for a conversation specifically about that. Am I right?
Yep. One of the things I always, you know, I see this on a lot of the lists. I see this on the Ubiquiti forum. You know, guys are on there and gals are on there, you know, trying to make their APs do all kinds of stuff. You know, VLANs, and some people are trying to make their APs doing routing and things like that. My major thing is make everything as modular as possible. You know, my current design is, you know, every site has two routers. One I consider a backbone router. You know, backhauls are connected to it. It participates in, you know, whatever the internal routing is, you know, usually OSPF. And then I have a AP router that handles all the customer functions, you know, access point, you know, throttling, triple PoE concentration, you know, stuff like that. That way, and we've talked before about, you know, in one of our last ones about, you know, multiple routers for BGP. You know, in my opinion, the less the router does, the easier it is to upgrade it.
For sure.
You know, so if you have, you know, two routers at each site, and you need to go in and say, you know, you need, you know, the latest, greatest, you know, function that may only, you know, do routing, you only have to upgrade one router, and it's not as detrimental to the entire network. You know, we always have the human factor. You can mistype something or whatever, so the less things that you have to worry about, the better.
Yeah.
Same with your APs. You know, APs should be just, to me, just dumb bridges. You know, they shouldn't be routing, you know, anything like that. So you come along with, you know, Andrew mentioned, you know, one time 802.11 AC. You know, hey, if I want to drop in a new latest, greatest access point, I don't have to worry about, you know, bugs in the software too much.
Yeah.
You know, if it's not doing much, there's not as much room for it screwing up.
Mm-hmm. And that's, I mean, that's super, super important to point out that you are going to hit bugs. You know, like if you find a bug in your code now, say with MV2 there's a bug, or I saw that in .18 they're going to be fixing a bug that has to do with, I think it's AP to APWDS, you know, something, some kind of broadcast storm problem. So if you have your wireless segregated, well, then you can just update, you know, that functionality on that router, and you don't have to worry about introducing OSPF bugs, you know, via this update, or vice versa. If your routing engine over here is having bugs, you can upgrade, you know, pretty much that portion, that functionality, without having to worry about, you know, changing things on your wireless infrastructure.
Still to this day, I'm unable to run OSPF across Ubiquiti AirMax radios using broadcast. I have to use NBMA, period.
Yeah, non-broadcast multi-access. That that configures it to use unicast communication instead of using the default multicast. I still have problems with Ubiquiti kind of Pac-Manning my multicast as well. Not exactly sure what the deal is there. But I know MikroTik, doing MikroTik links, like one particular location, I've got fiber actually out to the location, but to do kind of ring completion for it, I do a little SXT hop to another POP I have, and the OSPF, the Cisco OSPF that's running across that link, and the BGP works flawlessly. Before that, I had a Ubiquiti link, and it would work sometimes, and then sometimes I would just OSPF just could not come up on that link, you know, for whatever reason.
I found all kinds of workarounds to make it work. I guess I'm just too cheap to do anything else. So,
well, I think a lot of times you shouldn't be forced to make it work, to work around the bugs and flaws. I mean, it's obviously, if you're buying radios that cost, you know, $45, you're probably going to have some things you're going to have to work around. You know, you can't get everything for that kind of price, but still, the frustration factor is there.
Definitely. I've seen some people running GRE tunnels or EOIP tunnels across them, and then it seems like the broadcast traffic works fine as long as it's going across the tunnel. So.
Yeah, I run EOIP tunnels across most of the links on our ZIG network, mainly because we have unmanaged switches at the top of these towers and can't do VLANs. So that's, you know, my, you know, hanky way of trying to separate, you know, a bunch of backhauls plugged into the same switch.
Gotcha. So what do you think, Andrew? What's the key to future-proofing your network? Andrew? Cox? Can you hear me?
I will message him. You know, wireless world, the thing most people run into is the CPE. You know, that's the hardest thing about wireless networks. As more and more people are getting away from 802.11 and going to proprietary stuff, you know, you can swap out your AP, but what are you going to do about your customers? And then, you know, if you want to add an AP to a tower and, you know, slowly migrate customers over to the new system, do you have enough spectrum?
We're talking future-proofing it and building things modularly. What I'd be interested to know, Justin, what sort of overheads do you allow when you're provisioning in new links? I know, for example, in a lot of the links that obviously I work with, mainly LAN networks, and the parent company provides us with a lot of our wireless links. But say, for example, we need a 40 meg link, we'll normally get them to install 100 meg radio on the assumption that we'll go up to that band within in a short period of time. Do you think it's worthwhile that people provision things with a reasonable amount of overhead, or is it just a waste of money to do that when there's new products coming out all the time?
My quick thought on that is, in the WISP business, the biggest focus is, okay, let's, at least in our area, is let's try to get the bandwidth to them. We just want to get it to them. If we can get, 10 megs to a site and start throwing on customers, that gets us revenue right away. So, it's a little bit different than, say, you have a, customer down the street that wants 100 megs or, wants 50 megs today. We're kind of, at least our philosophy is, let's get it there as fast as we can get it. If we can get a 20 meg link in, great. If we can get 50 megs in, even better. But, we'll be happy getting them something.
That's the exact same philosophy that we use. Just build the network as fast as possible, and then allow the technology to catch up with what you're doing. My attitude has been, if I can build the network, get 10 megs out to the edge, I know that some manufacturer is going to make something in a year or two that's much, much faster that I can just go out and start augmenting my network with to increase the capacity out to the edges.
Yeah, I think Andrew and I are kind of in the same boat in that we generally have large customers and we just get a fat pipe to those guys and then we manage the infrastructure. We manage, because I do that a lot too, like with our apartment complexes. We dump, 50 to 60 megs, I guess generally is kind of the normal ballpark, and then we put a router out there, do quality of service, and, take care of it all the way down to the wall port. Some places we do some wireless backhauls, and for us, generally, we just try and meet capacity plus about 10% overhead. That's all we really look for in our links. Generally, we sign people into contracts for 3 to 5 years, and so we know at the end of that contract, if they need more bandwidth, a newer technology is going to be out there that's probably going to cost the same amount as our commodity gear does today. In that future time frame that'll support the new bandwidth requirements.
Yeah, just like
I
those,
guess there's you go.
Go ahead, Andrew.
I was going to say, I guess that could be due to both the fact that, well, one, we're paying a lot more for bandwidth over here, so you can't necessarily put a huge link in, but obviously, if a customer is happy with it and you can upgrade it over time, then sell them more bandwidth over time. The other side of it is when we're delivering to a site, we're providing ourselves. We being both the customer and the provider, obviously, if we see there's utilization there and we're getting revenue from the end users, then it's justification to say, let's ramp this up from 50 up to 70 meg, 90 meg, 100 meg or more. So don't have to worry about having people locked into contracts and things because we are the person buying that link.
Okay. So another aspect of that I guess you could take off of is, so if you're looking to future-proof, are you looking to reuse hardware? Say, and you can get a Microtik with an outdoor enclosure and antennas, and inside you can actually trade out the radio card and trade out the antenna eventually for newer technologies, or would you be more interested in using like the Ubiquiti rockets, bullets, or the Microtik metals SXT or the grooves? Exactly, where they're a built-in, or are you looking for more of a modular form factor? What would you prefer at this point? At this point in time.
I personally prefer the integrated units. Having to build something out of a bunch of components is not very attractive to me. I want to grab something out of the box, slap it together, go put it on the customer's house, collect my money, go on down the road to the next place, do wash and repeat this. Not really interested in putting a lot of stuff together unless it's like an AP. I don't mind to spend the extra time building AP, but on the CP end, not really interested in building all of them. Putting all these enclosures together, doing that kind of integration. The SXT and the we don't run a lot of Microtik wireless. We run some on backhauls here and there. Most of our Most of our point to multipoint stuff is all Ubiquiti right now. We've got a lot of Canopy out there as well. We've got a lot of SkyPilot, if anybody's ever used that. We've got a lot of Transio. I mean, it's kind of a hodgepodge, and you talk about future-proofing. I don't know that in a WISP network you can just future-proof it completely, because you get married into this hardware, and you can't just sweep around and have all the customers. You know, you might have a 100 CPEs out there, and you just, I don't know, just our business model is so lean and mean. You just can't go run around and swap out all these CPEs.
Well, I know. At least on the AP side, you can get a little bit more modular. But do you want to get more modular, or would you rather just buy an AP that's one solid unit that's already ready to go, like the Ubiquiti rockets, where you just screw them right into the sectors, mount them up, and you're done? Or because to me, I actually prefer that all-in-one form factor. I don't really. I mean, I've done it before,
definitely.
But I don't like having to change out the radio cards. I don't like, you know, having to actually assemble anything.
It adds more failure points.
It's a huge pain having to troubleshoot. Like, having to troubleshoot something that you've custom built, sure, you get the flexibility, but trying to work out, what, is there water in the connectors that I've made up here? Is there some damage to the wireless card? Whereas when you've got a single all-in-one unit, you just go, well, it's not working. I'll swap it with another one. Does this one work? Yes,
it makes it so much easier in the RMA process too. You know, it's like, because if it's something you custom assemble, whether the supplier is going to say, well, was the gasket good on the enclosure you used? Did you screw everything down tight? You know, if it's an all-in-one unit, it either works or it doesn't work. You know, there's nothing I could really normally do to it to break it.
Yeah, we've kind of taken the stance that the climbers don't really fix anything on the tower anymore.
Right.
You know, if it's suspected that there's water in the cable or whatever, you know, they get sent up a whole new unit, whole new cable. You know, usually it's sealed up, you know, as it goes up before it goes up the tower. So there's no opening the box on the tower.
Yeah. And I know right now on my towers, if I'm running four links on there, I drag up two spare cables and just seal off the ends like crazy and keep two spare cables at the tower. Because, you know, if not just leaks, but if you get a strike or a near strike, it's going to cook that cable all the way down. So it's, you know, it's going to be unusable.
Yeah, we pull extra cable too.
Cable's cheap.
Yeah, it is. And while you're pulling, you know, while you're pulling four, it's going to be a pain in the butt. You might as well pull one more at the same time or two more.
Yep.
It's not really that much difference.
No, just make sure you seal them up real good or they will get water in them. We just had five cables that we pulled for a job that laid down. Like, we didn't pull them all the way to the top of the tower. We kind of coiled them up on top of a catwalk about 60, 70 feet up a tower. And we taped them up real good, but still water puddled up. And we had to pull the cable again, all of it. It was like six runs. And we had to scrap all of it and start over.
You know what I've found that I like, and that I actually have some here, is what I've started doing with a lot of my connections is using liquid electrical tape. It's basically, it comes in a can just like PVC cleaner and glue, only it's black electrical tape. And so you can just smear this nasty stuff inside there, and it dries and it stays pretty flexible. And I've had it outdoors for, you know, kind of in a semi-covered environment for several years, and it still hasn't dried out and cracked, and does a really good job of staying flexible and keeping water out.
Very nice.
And I mean, it looks awful. It looks awful. It does. It looks terrible, but it does a pretty darn good job.
That's always a good thing. And shielded cable.
Ship something.
What was that?
You'll have to ship some to Australia, or we can use our own version, which is referred to as Vegemite.
Vegemite? I heard there was like a shortage over in, where was that? Or no, it was a shortage in, where are the Kiwis from?
New Zealand?
Yeah, they had some shortage of their national version, and they were having to switch over to Vegemite because they were running low on stock or something.
We'll include a picture on the post so people know what Vegemite is.
I hear it tastes terrible.
But it looks like that electrical tape gunk.
Is that what it looks like
probably,
when it comes out,
probably
too?
Probably tastes the same.
Looks better on the way out. That's what I like to say. Okay, so as far as future-proofing goes, equipment, it seems like most of us are of the same opinion. We like the solid units because we know we're going to get... I mean, what do you guys average on runtime on a piece of equipment? Say an AP, what are you looking at? Are you looking... I was around the five-year mark. I think, Justin, you said like 3 to 5?
Yeah, we always play in 3 to 5. You know, basically the reason we do that, when we had our last Wisp, you know, it's now 5 years old, and some of the hardware is still up there. We would have replaced the hardware 2 years ago. You know, mainly Microtik and Transio. It wouldn't keep up with the demands today.
We always move it further to the edge. You know, we might have an AP where you know, demand is greater, and we'll take that down, and I'm the eternal you know, cheapskate, I guess, and I'm trying to move all the equipment to the edge and reuse it and just optimize the usage of that. I mean, we have some places, especially the 900 meg Transio stuff that we've got up. It's back in some cove in between two mountains, and we might only be trying to service 4 or 5 people in some little community where there's only like 5 houses in this 10 square mile area.
And I'm also wondering, in the Wisp business generally, you don't have any competition from DSL or cable providers, that you're the only player in the game, and if you do have any competition, it's going to be from another Wisp. I would think most of your Wisps could, in 5 years, double their speed and still kind of keep up with the Joneses, but not have to actually upgrade any of their infrastructure, be able to keep their same equipment out there, because they usually give fairly low speed links to customers. Does that kind of ring true with you guys?
It does to a degree. I mean, we have areas where, you know, it doesn't make sense financially to put, you know, a full-blown state-of-the-art system out there. The customers just aren't there. But, you know, we're going into markets, too, where we're switching customers from cable.
Really?
They don't want to pay $60 bucks a month for cable, but they want, you know, something a little bit better than DSL.
Yeah.
So, you know, those markets can justify it. But, you know, we are going into areas where we do have to, you know, compete with them just because there is so much competition.
Everything I do is completely unserved. We don't have any area that we compete with another vendor, like head-to-head. I mean, we take on some synchronous connectivity for businesses in some areas. Like, we have this one fiber provider that charges $200 per megabit, and we've been taking customers away from them left and right, just because we're in a good situation with our bandwidth provider, and, you know, we can offer synchronous connectivity much more affordably. But that's always kind of an issue for us, because we're concerned that if that situation changes, what do we do then? You know, it basically, if our situation were to majorly change with our bandwidth provider, it would pretty much bankrupt us at this point.
Gotcha. So if your transit prices, or rather your internet connectivity prices, were to go up significantly, you're going to take a hit.
Significantly, because we've based our entire business model off of that affordable connectivity, so we pass that savings along to the customer.
Okay. So maybe another option of future-proofing would be find yourself a good provider that's going to scale up reasonably, you know, with you over long term.
Indeed. Yeah, we have a co-location facility. We could get a 10 gig circuit if we needed it. We're looking at multi-homing and, you know, getting our own IP space and working with another facility. But this other facility, you know, I got a quote from them just today, and just for transit across town, it's like 40 miles. I just got a ridiculous quote on a gig link, and they wanted, just for like local loop, they wanted $6,000 for a giggy, and I was, you know, it was just $6,000 a month plus a $9,000 install. So,
you're going to be doing a wireless shot, is what you're telling me?
Yeah. I was kind of processing out some 11 gig license links today. So,
okay.
And that brings up a good point. You know, if you're, you know, it's usually better off to spend money on your transport and your back end. You know, one of my goals has always been, we have a big data center in Indianapolis. You know, anybody that, you know, wants to start a WISP in Indiana that I've helped, you know, their one of their first major goals should be somehow to get to that data center. You know, they can buy cheap bandwidth there, and plus have access to a ton of other fiber, you know, providers. But, you know, they have to spend the money up front to be able to get there, but that allows their network to grow. They don't have to wait, you know, 7 weeks, 6 months, whatever, to get more T1s installed.
Right. Sure. As far as I've ever seen, the cheapest bandwidth prices are going to come out of a data center. Usually what we call them is carrier hotels. That's what they want to advertise themselves as, where they have as many carriers as they can possibly get in to have a point of presence in there. And it just, for one, whenever data centers are getting connectivity from, you know, point to point from various MPLS connections, the more providers you have, the better pricing your customers can get. But then that also translates to any WISPs that want to hang off there. You've got a lot more options as far as transport prices.
For sure.
So definitely going to be cheaper than a T1.
We did kind of a thing here in Indiana. We created a co-op of several ISPs. That way we have more buying power at the carrier hotels.
There you go. You guys unionizing, huh?
Yeah, kinda. Yeah,
you know, break some kneecaps.
But we're now buying, depends on what day you want to. You know, I don't want to advertise names or anything,
right,
but we're
right.
buying a good, what I consider a fairly decent backbone provider for around $1 a meg.
Okay. Yeah, and I know some providers out there that'll give it to you that cheap. Some of them have better names in the industry than others as far as oversubscription models go and reliability of their network. And you know what? From what I've seen, the quality of engineers they can get on the back end. But it tends to be those cheaper guys, often enough are a little bit hungrier, more flexible, a little bit more nimble. So you can usually kind of get more out of them if you want to.
Andrew, how's the, the market in Australia, I know, isn't you know, you guys are pretty heavily regulated.
I was going to say, like what we're saying about having co-ops of people buying bandwidth or sharing links, things like that. There is a reasonable amount of that going on here as well. I mean, I know the company I work for has a number of other business. They call them partners. They're not necessarily business partners as such, but partner companies that we work with to deliver services. So if they need a service such to a certain location and we have fiber there and we've got available capacity on it, we can assist them with that sort of thing. There's one particular area in Australia that if you're familiar with Australia, Tasmania is a state that's an island at the bottom of Australia, and there's only two main providers who bring fiber to there, and the cost of getting bandwidth to there is pretty much the same as what I would pay to get transit from Sydney to LA.
Wow.
Wow. Wow.
So you're saying we need to do some wireless shots out there.
It's a bit far for a wireless shot. Like, The gap between, like, across the water, possibly do with the wireless shot, but you wouldn't get any great bandwidth over that sort of distance. It's close to 50, 60 kilometers from
me. I was about to say, you better tell us in miles, that means nothing.
Yeah,
What is that, about 30 miles?
35
miles?
60 kilometers is like 40 miles.
I can do it. How much you need over there?
more than 100 meg.
We can do it.
That just means he's gonna keep adding access points over and over and over.
No, I was going to say, we'll put back-to-back air fiber points and float them on boys.
You know what, I did write an auto-aiming algorithm for a pan-tilt mount, so I think we could make something happen.
Just run some 12-foot dishes until the authority to go away on the IRP.
When someone complains their child's born with like three arms and
no, what we do is we go far enough into the water where we're like in international waters, and then we just put a little mast, sink it down, and we'll just do the wireless shot that way.
And enjoy watching the pirates come by. Ooh, free electronics.
That's when you point the access point right at the pirates as they're coming near you.
Microwave fry.
Just cook them, brother.
Well, and another thing to future-proof your network, kind of like what we're talking, is multiple backbone providers. Guys can go out of business. I've been around, long enough, been through the dot-com days where, you call up your backbone provider, we're sorry, this number is no longer in service. and if you're tied to those guys, you got problems.
Yeah.
And plus, there's always all kinds of mergers and, what we did yesterday, we're not doing today. So, gotta change.
My data center just got bought out, so I'm incredibly uneasy right now.
Nervous. We had a wholesaler that we were buying some of our circuits through, and they were there one day, and we were paying them, and the next day they weren't, and they weren't paying the people that we were getting our circuits from. So we started having rolling disconnects on our circuits that we had through these guys. We had to start making emergency phone calls and getting stuff up. So, you're absolutely right. You never know. And I guess in the wireless ISP business, redundancy's sake, if you're in one town and you're getting connectivity, if you can start building towards another town that has connectivity in kind of a diverse location, you're probably doing yourself a big favor. That way, if your networks got segregated somehow, you'd still have connectivity from both sides.
Indeed.
Oh, look, like the simplest problem that arises is that everyone has a failure at some point.
You do.
Even those companies that say they have 100% uptime, they still have outages. So
yep.
You get a second provider and you negate that outage for yourself.
That's right.
It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when.
Yeah, offering 100% SLA is a nightmare in and of itself, and it puts undue stress on your employees. You should give them a lot of time off for things like that. I'm just saying.
It's compounded momently.
But you know what? What's funny is you're talking about you're always going to have outages no matter what you do. Like computers, servers, hard drives, there's moving mechanical parts. They will fail at some point. Everything has a mean time between failures. It's going to fail. And then sometimes life will reach out and get you. Lightning, near hits, not sabotage, I guess, people hitting something with their car. And then one guy, my favorite case was, he was saying that he was putting his stuff on the side of a mountain. It's this guy in South Africa. And I was telling him, he was like, hey, I've got a friend named JJ, and he had some ice fall on one of his radios one time, because that's like in our mountains, we have problems with that. And he's like, yeah, we don't really have ice. We have baboons. They love tearing our radios up. And I said, are you serious? And he goes, this is Africa. And to me, that's like, ah, God, I felt, about as tall as an inch, so small. And just, yeah, I guess that's Africa. So it's just, you never really know what's out there. So a baboon just might get you to Mars to be ready for it.
We had some truckers come up and throw beer bottles at our sectors on a tower and like smash some of our older antennas with some like some 40 bottles.
I know somebody who had some cable running up the side to an AP, and some kids used it to scale the roof. They used the cable to scale their way up the roof. That was nice. It didn't work after that.
A term for fiber disconnections in Australia. It's a called backhoe attenuation. Right, someone's right. getting their dig on, and oh, look, is there some sort of cable there we've just cut through?
It's all this live.
There's one for you. Not
backhoe attenuation.
What is this?
We had some backhoe attenuation a while back. We had the misfortune of having some of our fiber run right over the top of the water main. So they're going to put in a tap, and they just right over the top of it. It's a nightmare. I hate that. It's just a short stretch, but I hate that stretch.
It
gives me heartburn every time.
On what they consider a protected sonnet ring with one of the national carriers, and we had an outage one time that lasted 27 hours.
Oh.
Well, their idea of a protected sonnet ring was conduits in the ground, 2 feet away is the protected ring. Well, backhoe buckets usually more than 2 feet wide.
Yeah, yeah. And they're not usually, they don't nibble. They don't take little bites either. They're kind of big bites. That's ridiculous. That breaks the heart.
I watched a guy pull a 400 count out of the ground one time, an AT&T 400 count with a backhoe. And it was like a peacock tail. It was just like, and it was all lit up as soon as he just pulled the bucket up out of the ground.
That's nice. At A&M, one of our colleges here, they had fiber running between buildings in a steam tunnel, and one of the steam pipes burst. And you should see the picture of it. It's just fiber, 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 and then there's just this huge, melted, gelatinous mass just sitting, laying on the floor. It's like, how do you prepare for that? How do you account for that? And I was just thinking how, because it was a chunk of like 6 feet that got melted out. So, you know, guys had to go in there and splice onto both sides of it. It was just horrible.
Speaking of splices, fiber and splices, that was one of the topics that I was wanting to cover. Justin probably knows more about this than myself. But when you run the fiber up the towers, Justin, what do you... mechanical splices, you puck and polish, you outsource it. What is your strategy there?
We actually just buy pre-terminated fiber. There's a couple companies we buy it from, and we've found that we can buy, say, 300 feet. We can buy a 300-foot run of multi-mode fiber. I'm trying to think how many strands. Six strand for about $250 shipped.
Nice.
And even if you buy the the Corning OptiCam ends with no polish and things, those things are $10-$15 a piece.
Yes,
so
sir.
you know on six strands you have.
You talking about the Unicams?
Ends. Yep, the Unicams, the
okay.
ones that are no polish.
Right, those are the mechanical splices.
Yeah. You have what's 12 times 15. You basically have half your fiber in just ends, not including your labor. So, we just, if we have extra, great. We try to have an extra 20 foot or whatever. But yeah, we just buy, it comes on a roll and we just up the tower it goes.
Yeah, and the great thing about ordering that preterm stuff is it's always guaranteed. It's pre-tested. When it comes to you, we still pre-test our stuff, but no matter what you want, whether you want multi-mode, single-mode, multi-mode, 50-micron laser optimized, they'll give it to you. If you want the Corning bend insensitive, you get that. If you want armor-clad, which is basically you can hit it with a hatchet and it's not going to hurt it,
yep.
You can get that preterm, and that will easily strap to the outside of a tower and go straight up. And
don't have to worry about your techs going through 10 ends and running out on the day they're trying to do their install.
Exactly. Or some guys do puck and polish. If it's particularly cold outside, the glue's going to take forever to harden. If it's too hot, it's going to harden too fast. The mechanical splices, you don't get as clean a cut, as you normally would. It's just there's so many advantages, especially the time saving. You can get any guy... they can pull a cable to pull preterm fiber. There's
yep.
no specialized knowledge. Just tell them not to hit it. Don't tie a knot in it, you know, use some common sense and make it done.
We've got some municipal jobs right now where all the buildings have fiber pulled between them and none of it's terminated. And, you know, I've been tasked with either contracting somebody to terminate it or doing it ourselves. So we were, you know, we were trying to figure out, you know, what do we want to do? And, you know, it looks like you can get the Corning Unicamp kit, you know, for about $700-$800 or so. And then, you know, this is a 6-count fiber. It's a single mode fiber on each end. There's probably about a half mile in between ends, and just trying to figure out what we want to do at this point. I mean, it looks like there is some money for us to be made if we just get the kit and do it ourselves versus having someone contract it. So
my thought on that is the advantage of a contractor, and this is, you know, something you'd have to ask the contractor, is can they certify those runs? You know, do they have the, and I don't know, Greg can probably help me out here. You know, I call it an oscilloscope. You know, what's the, you know, I've been on jobs where the guys bring in the, you know, the thing that verifies it and prints it out and says, you know, this, here's the stats.
Yeah, it's called an OTDR.
Okay.
And with an OTDR, they can actually send light and then see how much reflection is. If there is a break, they can tell you physically how far it is into the cable. They could tell you a lot. But you know what? To me, if you get a contractor to come out there, those guys, and you mean not all of them, but all the ones that we use, they guarantee their work. So if they come out and do a connector today and it breaks 2 years from now, you know, for some reason, they will go and fix it. Even if it's 3 a.m., they're out there fixing it, and I'm not having to pay for that. I'm not having to get up and deal with the blowback from it. You know, it kind of limits your liability in the whole situation.
Right. I can imagine there's some merit to learning to do it yourself, though. Like, if you want to do your own terminations and things. Alternatively, having your contractor come out and actually watching them and learning from them. So obviously, they're the people that do it every day, so...
Yeah.
I've got a friend in the neighborhood that he was operating a GPON network, and unfortunately, his business adventure failed him miserably. He paid the price of the early adopter, and he's got Fusion Splice hardware. And you know, I've spent some time with him and watched him terminate. So, you know, he did everything himself. They ran hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles of underground fiber on this passive optical network. And he did everything with Fusion Splices. You know, he had a $30,000 apparatus. You just pop both ends in, hit a button, and you were done, you know, if you were splicing it. And it would line it up. It was so amazing to watch it. It would just line it up on a computer screen and do some magic, and then it just kind of melted them together.
Yeah, then you slide up the tubing, put it in the heater, and you move on to the next strand. You know what? When I learned to do all that stuff, the thing that I really learned was that I didn't want to do it, you know. It's like, that's cool, and I can do it, but I never want to do it again. Cat 5, I do Cat 5 probably. I still, even though I'm the engineering manager, I still have to do Cat 5 probably every 3 or 4 days. I'm terminating cable or I'm punching down cable. So that, inevitably, I'll never get away from. But fiber, I can easily get out of, and I refuse to do it anymore.
It definitely sounds like it is. Go ahead, Andrew.
Even Cat 5, I mean, you look at, we've got a new student accommodation installed. That's a bunch of 48-port switches, a bunch of half-meter-long Ethernet cables. So I'm not going to make them up myself. That would take me most of the week to do and test them all.
You know what we started doing?
They're already done.
What we started doing in the data center we order this is going to sound so lazy. We order preterm Cat 5. Cat 5e, and it'll come in bundles of 24, and then we get our NOT guys to pull all that stuff, and then we put in modular patch panels that have basically 48 couplers on it, and then we just pluck, 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 and then, I mean, it's up in no time flat, and we didn't have to do anything. I mean, yeah, it's going to cost you more, but if you look at the price of labor, and you factor the time and expense that it would take to actually do all that yourself, it works out usually about the same, even if it is slightly more expensive. You saved a lot of time.
I like some of those new Panduit ones that have the little tab that flips under the tab. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, if you just bump it when you're pulling in a, you know, another cable out or something, if you bump the, you know, the release tab, it doesn't just fall out on the floor and you go, whose cable was that, you know?
Well, that comes back to you should be labeling every single cable.
Right.
Silence. Exactly. Just crickets chirping after I said that. Chirp, chirp.
The patch was another one we used in the past just for cable management, and the fact that they actually have kits that come with like 24 or 48 cables, and they're all unbagged, they're all untied, they're just ready to go. So they've got tied in one big bundle. Whereas if you're buying them from a wholesale like we normally do, well, here's 500 bags, I've got to tear the thing off, pull it out, undo the twist ties. There goes half my day just doing those.
Yeah, the preterm, the bundle, the bulk preterm we get comes already in one big nylon sock, so it's all bundled together. They even will stagger the ports for you, so it'll be like 1 and 25 will be shorter, and that way everything cleanly dresses right in. And they'll also stagger them for whatever chassis you're using. So for us, all of our hardware, like our 6500s, where we plug in customers, we preterm everything. So it staggers nicely, goes back up into a patch panel. That way our technicians never get near the actual hardware. They just go to patch panels. You know, every patch panel is labeled. So all I have to do is tell this guy, plug a cable from, you know, this place to this place, and then up here, plug it from this place to this place, update our documentation, and I mean, that's it. It makes it so that anybody that can read can do this.
Well, I had a data center job. We ran 6 fiber cross connects in this 3-story data center, and we hired a contractor to terminate the fiber. We ran the fiber. Dropped it in place, and then as soon as we got the first one done, the fiber contractors came behind us and terminated the cables. And those guys, they got it down to where they were doing one end every 5 minutes. And I don't know if that's good or bad, or you know, but that's the pace good. That they kept. I know I couldn't do it in 5 minutes.
Yeah, I know we have guys that. That if we do have to get it terminated, they come out and they puck and polish. We don't usually do mechanical. And those guys puck and polish, I think, for about $40 to $45 a connection. That's usually what it cost us. Per termination, it's about $40, $45. That's
probably
puck and polish.
Half of that is materials.
Yeah, so it's if you think about it, you're getting the peace of mind that somebody else is warranting this. You know, they're going to test it when they're done with it. And another thing is I don't have to get up from my desk. That's really nice, too. See? Cause
you got to tell from the Skype window, but Greg actually goes like this. It's fat on the lower side.
If I can go a day without having to get up, it's been a good day. You know? It just... Because... I'm the kind of person that I focus on one thing at a time, and I'm like, I laser focus in on it. So if I get interrupted and I have to stop, then I have to kind of reacclimate and get back into it, and it drives me crazy. Like, here these last few days, I've been working on a program. And this is completely off subject, but I've been working on a program. So when I have to stop and come back, I have to get my brain going back again. So
I thought you were sleeping and watching TV.
No. No, not when I'm at work.
What is it they say? Lazy people come up with the better and more efficient solutions because they don't want to do as much work.
Efficiency experts, man. Efficiency experts. So we talked about future proofing. We talked about fiber termination.
One thing I wanted to add on the fiber thing real quick is we found running fiber up the tower, if we're going above 200 feet, fiber is only about $200 more for us than running Cat 5. Huh. So we get all the benefits of, you know, no water in the cable, You know, the electrical isolation, everything like that. Because we figure if we're going to run six runs of Cat 5 over 200 feet, you know, we're going to burn through at least two boxes. So,
what are you guys rocking at the top of the tower for, you know, converting back to a
media termination?
Yeah.
We're using industrial switches. Usually they're an 8-port job with two fiber ports.
You'd be switching to RB2011 soon?
Yeah.
Probably.
You know, something interesting on that, I just talked to a distributor today. He was said that I was surprised in that MikroTik is fulfilling all of my orders and they're shipping now, so I should have them. I think he said available on the website Friday and shipping Monday, so that might actually include those new 2011s with the SFP ports.
Well, I would just have to hit up that website. I'm sure it's probably somewhere in Illinois.
I don't know. I'm trying to be vendor neutral right now, so we'll talk afterwards.
right.
But anyway, so Andrew was saying, are you guys going to be switching to the 2011 to get the SFP termination, which would, I guess, eliminate an entire piece of hardware? Because you could use the, say you could use the five ports and just turn on the ASICs on the five Ethernet ports and have them act as a switch.
You know, without a doubt, I'm going to.
Yeah, my only concern will be how they will fare the weather.
How are they going to hold up?
If I got a device, you know, 450 feet on top of the tower, is it going to survive the Indiana weather?
Are you encasing these in like a NEMA enclosure?
Yeah, they're going in a NEMA enclosure. We've been buying the extended temperature switches, which there is an actual specification for an extended temperature industrial switch. It goes down to like neg 30.
You're still putting a router in there, though, right?
Our routers are at the bottom.
Okay, so routers are actually at the bottom. So the only thing you have up at the top are APs and your industrial switch that comes down, and then the router is at the base of the tower.
Yep, we got industrial switches, the POEs, and that's pretty much it at the top.
That's funny, because I was thinking heat at the top, but you're actually talking about cold.
Yeah, we haven't had problems with heat. We've had problems with cold. When we first started, we got two switches that were not the extended temperature, and they were rated to zero, and almost like clockwork, about 4 a.m., couple days, it dipped below zero, and they would lock up about 8-9 o'clock when the temperature raised, they'd come back alive.
And I guess, unfortunately, those switches were too efficient to put off enough heat to keep them warm.
Yeah.
What's the cost on something like those extended temperature switches, if you don't mind saying here?
We've been buying them for $175 a piece, I think.
Is that with an optic in them?
Yes, that is with the multi-mode optic in them.
See, that's not bad at all.
Not at all.
No. They're a 6-net switch, 6-net brand. And they, you know, they perform well. We haven't had out of, you know, close to 50 towers now, we've not had one fail.
You said those are unmanaged, though, right? So you can't
ping
them or
anything. They are unmanaged. That is the problem. See, the difference between a industrial managed switch and an unmanaged switch is about $1,000.
Wow. Okay. That's a
pretty
big difference.
What size frames will they handle?
Good question. We've not run into framing issues yet. But they are, you know, an unmanaged switch.
So. Are you going to try and run, like, jumbo frames or something, JJ?
No. I was just thinking, you know, I like a little wiggle room in case, you know, I don't like to rely on change TCP MSS on
I got
everything.
You. So what JJ is talking about for you guys that maybe don't know is the frame size or the, like, the MTU of the packet. It's a maximum transmission unit, so it's the largest amount of data you can squeeze into a packet before you try and send it across a network. If you're swimming across a layer 3 interface and the MTU of your packet's bigger than the MTU set on the routed interface, it'll do one of two things. It'll either fragment the packet, so it'll chop it into smaller pieces and send it on, or it'll drop the frame and send back a specialized ICMP message that tells you to readjust to this other MTU. If you hit a layer 2 device, like the switch they're talking about, and your packet's bigger, it'll just silently discard the packet. It'll just go into the bit bucket, and you'll never know why. So an MTU on a layer 2 device can be actually a pretty big deal. Anyway, that's my addition to the conversation.
Yeah, thank you. I like that.
Yeah.
What'd you guys think about those kind of going off in a, you know, veering off in like I like to do, you know, all the way here. The hot lava.
Let's save that for last, JJ. Let's save that for last. I'll make a quick note.
Okay.
Let's put this one to bed real quick. So that's cool. Yeah, so I don't even know. What are the temperature? Let me look up the temperature specs really quick on that router, on that new router board.
If it's extended, you know, what I would consider extended temperature, that's going to solve, you know, a lot of problems for several guys, because it's hard. It's very hard to get a managed. Managed is expensive, and then you add in managed gigabit. And you're, you know, you got a couple $1,000s of electronics at the top of the tower.
For sure. I hate having anything that's not managed. I'm such a control freak, I guess. But it says the temperature range on those guys is negative 30 centigrade to positive 70 centigrade. So
good.
What is that?
Pretty freaking huge range.
Justin, if you have any problems with them, I'll do you up a script that just runs a constant bandwidth test, because you're only going to be using the switching functions anyway, so use the router CPU, heat it up a bit. I'm sorry, it might use 1 or 2 watts more power, you know. But
how about we just put a toaster in the top of the tower with it?
What are they? Six watts. So we can schedule it so it only turns on during winter. So in winter you've got an extra 1 to 2 watts power consumption with that.
There you go.
And keeping it warm.
I've actually got a 2011 to deploy tomorrow at a site that we need more ports, and so it'll be the first one I actually have on my network. But I deployed 2 at a courthouse a couple months ago, and one of them locked up about 2 weeks ago. They had it plugged into a drop cord. None of the wiring was done. When I go into these places, it seems none of the wiring is done, and I just kind of have to like hodgepodge it all together. It comes after me and finishes everything. Well, they didn't plug it into a UPS or anything, and the one in the basement was completely locked up on them. So.
They did a reboot fix it?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Did.
Yeah, I've had issues where the watchdog or whatever doesn't necessarily pick up and reboot the unit. That's only happened, I guess, a few times or whatever. Well, that's cool. So these may actually be shipping pretty soon. That'd be cool, especially with that temperature range. It's managed, so now you can at least ping it, turn on the switching ASICs, let them do what they're going to do, but you can still ping the device to see if it's up or down or kind of what's going on.
And do tests and things like that as well, I think. So.
For sure. And I think there'll be a lot of value just to see if an interface is up and running or not. You know, is the
and what it's linked at. You know, is it 100 full? Is it 10.5? You know, what it actually link at.
Exactly. If you're having issues, you can hard code them 100 full to whatever.
That is one of the things that we religiously do. We have a lot of interference from low band radios and stuff we're co-located with, and we have to force Ethernet on each end. So I can't just, most of the time I can't just dump in, unless the cable run is really, really short, we refuse to just dump into, you know, if the cable run's 100 foot or so, I can't just dump into a dumb switch. I gotta know what's on that other end. Otherwise, you know, I'll start getting these bottlenecks and I can't track them down, unless I have that visibility.
It's crucial.
I've known. But I think the RB2011 for me personally is probably my favorite MikroTik router that they've made in some time.
Personally, I don't know.
I'm very interested to deploy it and see how it goes, because there's a lot of our sites that could benefit from that.
I'm really excited to see them go. But to say it's my favorite, I think right now the 751 is kind of my favorite. I've deployed like a million of these little things right now. The little the MikroTik. It's basically the 750 with the extension on it, so that it's got three antennas, runs
okay, yep.
Two
let
chains
ask,
on
let
one,
me
and
ask
then
you
the
guys this. Do you guys anywhere have a need for a million packets per second?
No.
No.
So can I say what's I don't know what that works out to. I guess it depends on my traffic. But
yeah, megabits per second is going to be different. Yeah, like are we talking about large packets or small packets or?
Yeah, I was going to say megabits per second.
Yeah, let's say it's a gig, 1500 byte frames, a million packets per second.
Okay.
Well, the largest site we have in terms of speed is currently about 280 meg. But that's being done on x86 because can't get the CPU performance on anything else at the moment. So it'll be interesting to see if something like the CCR will be okay, useful for okay. that.
Right. Yeah, everything for me that's, say, 50 or better, I do on an x86 just because I could put an x86 together really cheaply.
Okay, well, I was just curious.
Yeah. And anything that's a really high-speed link for me, it's Cisco. It's going to be a Cisco core.
If you would you be interested in a product that was affordable that did that type of performance?
I think it depends on the application. I would never use one in a data center environment where there's absolute guarantees on equipment because that's a whole different conversation. We'll get into that another day. That's right. A black hole I don't want to go down. But for ISPs kind of at their border, I can see people doing that as long as it's got the feature that they're looking for. You're being kind of vague. So
yeah, intentionally. Sorry.
Yeah.
I definitely would consider using them at that border the site setup, but alongside something else. So
yeah, I mean, yeah, and for sure for me a border router needs a few things. It needs you know, whatever dynamic routing protocol, it needs to be able to handle that. It needs to be able to handle your access list, so your firewalling needs to be able to, you know, because most of that stuff's going to be done via the CPU. So just raw packets, I mean, that's not very indicative of what it can really handle. And then it needs to have some quality of service capability. So I'm willing to bet something moving that much traffic, that many packets, probably doesn't have much CPU left over to handle any of those other things.
Right.
Depending on what product we're talking about, since we're being
okey-dokey.
So vague.
Okie dokie.
Yeah. That's my opinion. It's got to have all the features I want.
That's some good feedback there.
Well, I don't know anybody that just has a pure router like that on the edge.
And if my thing is like Greg says, if I'm going to use it in the data center, I got to be able to call somebody, and it gets fixed. I don't want to go through a forum. I don't, if I use Cisco in the data center, because if I got a problem with it, I can call somebody and it's fixed.
Right, and also. Cisco carries that name. So if I get a customer in here that's never heard of MikroTik, I can guarantee you they've heard of Cisco. So they like the sound, that kind of comfort factor, whether it's warranted or not, it's there. Just off the name.
Indeed. I was just curious what you guys thought there.
To me, something that moves that much raw data, lacking features, isn't going to attract a lot of people in the WISP industry. How's that?
Sounds good.
Yeah, if it's that critical, if it's moving that much bandwidth, it's a high-value piece of equipment.
Agreed. Okay. My attitude on it is if you're moving that much traffic, you're not worried about $100 routers.
No. I mean, Lord, no.
Yeah.
Not even close. At least not in this country. Maybe other countries where, it's... I don't know, maybe money's tighter or something. I think people would rather pay for the peace of mind. All right, so did we put the fiber to bed?
Fine by me.
Okay, so we put the fiber to bed. What's the next part? So we're nearing an hour, so let's try and put a bow on this baby. Let's see, what's something quick that we could talk about?
Let's do the oh crap moment.
The oh crap. All right. So now that Justin said that we'll do the oh crap moment, everything will break on the recording, and I don't have the heart to restart it. So this is it. You get one shot. So, I was doing a little article a while back because somebody brought me a Nauta cable from an oh crap moment we had. You know what? I'll just talk about that one. That one's more interesting and more fun. I used to work at this place called UCS, and we had an analog phone system back there, back in the day. And we were switching over to voice over IP, Cisco Call Manager, and so we had a ton of, like, 50-pair copper that was just dead, you know. And so a whole army of underpaid employees, so they told us, okay, we'll pull all the unused stuff out and recycle it. So, you know, I made note of everything that was unused, and so I started removing it, and then I was getting ready to leave for the day, and there was a guy that was going to stay till about 8 o'clock, I think, for whatever reason. So I showed him which stuff to go ahead and finish off removing, and guy's name was David. Super nice guy, very eager, just very eager. Let's just say that. He's a very eager guy. Really nice guy. Anyway, he took over, and I left at about 6:45. I get a call, and he says, "Hey, Greg, I cut one of the wrong cables, and it's the one that goes to the call center." So I was like, "Oh, okay. I'll tell you what. Just meet me there at 5 in the morning, and we'll fix it." You know. And so I got off the phone, and you know, I complained to my wife a little bit about it, and then, you know, went back to whatever. 10 minutes later, I think, maybe 15. I get another phone call, and it's David again. He goes, "Greg, just cut another cable." I said, "David, are you serious? Look, just put the cutters down and leave now, and meet me up here at 2 in the morning, and we'll fix it." So we left, or rather, he left for the day, and then we met up there at 2 in the morning. We're up on the ladder, and so we removed the sheathing from one of the cables, you know, and then he removed it from the other one, start splicing, and then from this copper cable, and I started soldering it, and I was like, "Oh my God, this is taking forever. We're never going to finish." And so we started just twisting the cables together in electrical tape, and we ended up at the end of it, in the middle, about a baseball-sized mass of electrical tape, just this huge blob of black tape that we just kind of tucked up in and hid it in there. And he finished his 5 minutes before the call center opened up, and somehow all of the lines that were in use still worked. It was amazing. I don't know how, but it somehow worked. Because I know in there, it was inside each sheathing was two identical. This is the interesting part that I didn't mention. Inside the sheeting, the outside sheeting, there were two individual rolls inside that were color-coded with just a little pull string. And he had cut the pull string back from all of them, so he didn't know which one was which. So he just started putting them together, and somehow he lucked out and got all of the right pairs together.
Wow.
It was amazing. So that was one of my oh crap moments. It's like... and that one wasn't necessarily caused by me, but it was an adventure, and it made a memory, evidently. And I'm sure I've got plenty more that I can probably dole out over time. And I know these other guys have some too. I know Andrew has started twice now on his, so hopefully he'll make it through. Maybe Andrew's the cursed one. Maybe that's why.
Yeah, we started before and had to retry. Oh, my one was pretty simple, and I'm sure many people have done this to make myself feel a little bit better. I was doing some work on a consulting client's router. I set up their core router, and I've set up a couple of their site routers, so we'll come back to a single data center. And at the same time, I was also doing some testing work on a MikroTik VM. Which we had running just on a trial license because we were testing some new configurations. So 24-hour trial license, shut it down when you're done with it, and that way you keep the time so you can bring it up tomorrow and continue your work. Anyway, so I just finished this. So it was like 4:30 in the afternoon or something. So, I'll just shut down this router system, shut down. Cool. And I've just looked up at the the heading and suddenly realize it's the client's core router. Oh crap. So I called them up. I'm like, I just wanted to let you know I accidentally shut down your router. I need someone to repower that for me. That's not a particularly easy phone call to make. But fortunately for me, the guy thought it was quite funny at the time, so they just restarted. They had internal access to it via IPMI, so remote access card, but that wasn't available to me because I was external to the site. So they only have one upstream at the moment. So there's another point about the old future proofing, getting a second upstream or a backup. But yeah, I mean, I can think of a couple of times I've shut down routers that weren't the ones I wanted to shut down, or I've hit shut down instead of reboot.
Reboot.
And you have to get someone to repower.
You know what's worse than that is having to email a customer and say, can you issue this command? Because I just removed your default route, or I just removed the IP address from your interface.
Oh wow. Okay. The worst one I've ever seen is... And I don't know why they have this. I think they should fix this in the RouterOS terminal. If you push Control V, it switches to autocomplete commands. So if you start typing in SY, it'll jump straight to system.